Welcome to the Life 2.0 podcast. I'm John St. Augustine. Glad to have you with me. Honored, really, to have you listening. And I'm not supposed to put benchmarks in these shows, meaning if I say it's such and such a date, you don't listen for 4 months. It kind of makes things obsolete. But I'm making a point that today is a very important day, whether you listen to it when it's being dropped, as we call it in the business, on Tuesday, December 3rd, or you listen 6 months from now. In this show is opportunity for you to make a world of difference. Let's get to it. All right, we're going up the down staircase in the outdoor one more time because that's what I do. You should be doing it at this point as well. You know, when you look between the lines, you know, under the headlines, into the lifelines, that's where life really takes place. So a lot of the stuff going on in the world today, I could kind of give a shit. Can't do anything about it. And I think that creates a sense of apathy. If all you do is spend time in the headlines and get pissed off and not be able to do something about what is going on, then we become apathetic. And Jane Goodall said on this show, she told me, I said, Jane, I think I called her Dr. Jane, what's the most difficult thing we're up against as a species? And she said apathy, that the problems we've created as a species, that there's nothing we can do about it, even though we're the ones creating it. Fascinating, don't you think? Carl Jung would have a field day with all of us at this point. So for me, I make every effort possible in every single episode that I put out to find some way, shape, or form that you can apply these things in your life and make a change. I am no guru. I don't want to be a life coach. You know, I just find that common sense for uncommon times is a really important thing, and that's where I spend most of my time. And today is one of those shows where I'm kind of stuck because I'm in the middle here of two incredible women who are doing incredible work in the world, one from loss and one from gain, and I wanted to put both of them in the same show, and it's not going to happen. And that's okay, because now I got an extra show I could put in. But for, as someone who feels pretty adept at taking nothing and making it into something, especially when it comes to audio and interviews and conversation and content and all that stuff, I was at a loss. On one hand, I have my longtime friend Joan Leafman, who is just an incredible force of nature and has always been that. But after the death of her daughter, Corbin, she became a force of nature in a different direction. And then on the other hand, I have Kathleen Falsani, longtime pal, incredible author and columnist. She's known to her legions of followers around the world as God Girl because all the work she does is in that religious, spiritual aspect. And the books that she writes, the columns that she writes, the travels that she takes, and her own personal story with her son and her husband is beyond belief. So I've been thinking for at least 2 weeks, how do I put both of them in the same show? Because Joan is all about making sure kids don't go to bed hungry. That is Corbin's legacy. It's what Joan and her group does every single day, 365, 24/7. And then on the other hand, Kathleen is a co-author of a book about ending world hunger. Would seem to be a match, don't you think? Looks good on paper, not so much in my mind. So as I've wrestled with this back and forth, I've come to the conclusion that we can't have enough around hunger, that there's not enough messaging that could possibly ever take place to get across the point that in this country, for sure around the world, but in the United States of America, in our own backyards, there are children who go to bed without enough to eat. You know, we're sitting here batting our gums about this and about that, and billions over here, and building walls and all this other, and our kids going hungry. In this great land. You want to make America great again? Feed the children. That's a pretty good start. And so as I decided to split those two shows apart, it came on me that standing right in the middle of this, there's a huge opportunity. And the opportunity is yours and it's mine. You're hearing this show on Giving Tuesday, which is December 3rd, which is a global generosity movement, unleashing the power of people and organizations to transform their communities and the world. It was created in 2012 as a simple idea, a day that encourages people to do good. Over the past 7 years, this idea has grown into a global movement that inspires hundreds of millions of people to give, to collaborate, and then celebrate their generosity. And one of the best ways to get involved is in your own community. And so this show is a simple way for you to take $20. You know, it's the same thing I squawk about all the time on having people subscribe to this show. It basically costs $20 for me to get a pizza down the street here at Rocky's with cheese and sausage. If I want to get the mushroom, it's like $21, something like that. I could pick it up, no delivery charge, we're good. But anyway, it's $20. $20. Now listen, I get it. I've been there where $20 was a lot of money, and I've been there where it's not. And so somewhere in the middle, we all live. And so this show today has one specific purpose. You're going to hear an interview I did with Joan from 2016 when this podcast was part of the CBS lineup called Play.it. And at that time, it was called Life Matters. And it did pretty well. As I was getting ready to listen to Kathleen's audio, it dawned on me that I had had a similar conversation around hunger with Joan and Corbin's Legacy, which is the movement that she has started since her daughter passed away. And I went back, found the audio, cleaned it up, and I thought, okay, you know, again, as I said, how do I put these two incredible women in the same spot? It just wouldn't do them justice to edit to the point where it would be something that you could listen to in a reasonable amount of time. It'd be 3-4 hours long, and even I can't hang that long. So this is very simple today. It's December 3rd. It is Giving Tuesday. What you're going to hear now is our conversation from 2016. And Joan and her husband, like many, unfortunately, going through the greatest loss that a parent could ever have. And then finding ways to turn grief into gain for those who are less fortunate, who go without. And this isn't just a Christmas thing or a holiday thing. This is an all-year-round thing. Unfortunately, at this time of the year, you know, we get pulled apart a lot to give here and give there and donate here and donate there, and I'm good with all that. So this is my pitch today. I'm asking you straight up to listen to this show, to listen to Joan's story, and to make a $20 deposit on Giving Tuesday to Corbin's Legacy. And here's what you're going to get for $20. When I spend $20, what do I get? I get a pizza. When you donate to Corbin's Legacy, $20 feeds a child for 2 weeks over winter break. 42 meals that kid gets over winter break. And it's almost beyond my comprehension that 1 in 4 children go to bed hungry and that 1 in 6 don't get needed medical care. The mission of Corbin's Legacy is to improve outcomes of underrepresented elementary school children through the elimination of food and medical insecurities. And since they live in Arizona, they focus their efforts there, but they're all our kids, right? My friend John Powers, who passed away, I think about 7 years ago already, said that you're really not a parent till you see all the children of the world as your own. And that's really what this is all about. In the midst of indescribable loss and grief, Joan has taken it upon herself to make sure that the kids in Arizona specifically don't go to bed hungry. And that's how the world changes. $20 feeds one child. This Christmas break for 2 weeks, they get 42 meals for $20. And Joan and her team will make sure that that happens. And so there's a link on this page where you download the Corbin's Legacy. You can read all about what they're doing. It's all on the up and up. But this is someone who I've watched over the years. I've known her since I was a student in college. And we've been friends a very, very long time. And to watch her pain turn into some sort of purpose is nothing short of inspiring. So please, one more time, listen to this clip. Please, go to the link, make a $20 donation. You're going to feed a kid for 2 weeks over this break what they have coming up for school, and that child will have 42 meals because of you. That is how you make a world of difference. There's a little disclaimer here on this show. It occurred to me about a week ago, talking with a friend of mine, that if all I did was have shows with the more noted of names in society, the people that I've worked with that have been on reality television and sold a kajillion books and do seminars, and that's all well and good. There's a time, place, and space for that. But in talking with my friend, I realized, too, that some of the most important conversations, the most conversations that had the most impact on me, they don't happen on radio. They happen in private. Of course, a year ago, once this show started getting geared up, I had to have a page that says I'm a public person.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Important, right? I think once we leave the house, we're all public people, but that's a whole different show. So I was having this conversation with a friend of mine who I've known for, well, probably 30 years. And she and I were in the same orbit when I went to college. I think she was obviously an instructor there. I was just a pissant student trying to make my way in the world. And we've been friends ever since. And I was very dismayed to hear of her daughter's passing about a year. It was a year ago, January, Corbin. And I've watched over the last year and a few months on Facebook, which is the, you know, the virtual landfill. Everything goes into Facebook. There's, I don't know, like a billion people listening now or something. I'm not really sure. Billion listening to me? No. Billion people posting on Facebook at one given time or another. And so I've watched this, and there's a lot of things about Facebook I'm not a big fan of, but staying connected to people and watching what they're doing and sifting through all that, that I am a big fan of. So my friend Joan Leafman, hard to call her Joan, but usually I yell her name, which is Jowdy. She has agreed in some way, shape, or form to spend a little bit of time with us because I found it really, really important, the work that she's doing in her daughter's name and the challenges that so many of our kids face today that get brushed aside while we're listening to the likes of Trump, Cruz, and Clinton bat their gums about and things that they say are important, while all the time in all of that, so much is going on that could be, we could actually do something about besides just going to a voting booth. And so Joni joins me from Arizona. Joni, glad to have you.
Thank you, Johnny.
Yeah, Johnny. I don't know where that yelling thing came. It was probably me.
I don't know. I think Betty.
Yeah, so I think it used to be across the gym at Northeastern. And I when I first went to school there, like I think you were there, there was no gym. The gym was connected to the main building. It was before they built that monolithic structure that sits out near Foster Avenue in Chicago at Northeastern Illinois University. There's a shameless plug for my alma mater. But you were there since the 70s, weren't you?
I was. I started working there in 74, I think. I think we were in a sort of a broom closet. You know, the gym was, you know, like a sunken bathtub.
Yes. They had this, the basketball court was dropped down below, you know, it was like, it probably, you know, people would sit around, maybe held, what, 150, 200 people? I don't know. But when I went there, first time was in 77, and that's where I met the, you know, everybody talks about the 6 degrees of Kevin Bacon. That's crap. It's 4 degrees of Dan Creeley.
Right.
I have come to the conclusion that this guy, Dan Creeley, I'm 4 people away from him all the time. I'll run into people and like, do you know Dan Creeley? There is actually somebody came up with buttons that they wore on their lapels. I know Dan Creeley. And I met him in 77 when I took a class. Where else can you go to college and take a class in fishing?
Right.
So I took a fishing class and that's how I started to get indoctrinated and all that. And I went to the service for a few years and came back and finished my degree from 86 to 87 to 92, somewhere in there. And then, you know, obviously you and Betty and Dan, of course, we all kind of became thick as thieves. And then life intervenes and everybody kind of goes their separate ways and we stay in touch as best we can. And in some way, I'm sure you heard me do this little buildup. You know, Facebook, I'm not sure what to make of it most times. You can get lost in the sea of stuff, or you can rise at the top and ride the wave for a while. And I was, you know, again, my deepest condolences. I don't know what it's like to lose a child. You do, and your husband. And when I heard of this, I was so hurt that I didn't say anything because I don't know that you can say anything. So I've watched all this time, and I've watched some really amazing things come out of Corbin's passing. But before we get into all that, which we will, I thought it was really important that people know who she is and was and why this has affected so many people as it has.
Well, thank you. And I truly appreciate your sentiment. I think there are no words. My greatest fear among, you know, my deep grief was that Corbin would not be remembered, because life goes on as it should, you know, and people feel bad, but people heal. And what I didn't want was simply for my family to become collateral damage, that Corbin's spirit needed to live on. And so I thought for a while about what to do and met with my family, periodically when we were able to talk about it. But when it became very clear that that was sort of my greatest fear and my family's greatest fear, we thought long and hard about what to do. And this Corbin's legacy sort of organically erupted. And when I say organically erupted, I mean the theory of it and the practice of it. When you have the Leisman family getting together, you know, the naming of it, not so much.
Right.
As, you know, I like to refer to us as sort of, you know, like the angry board of directors. But, you know, if I waited for a majority rules on the name, we would still be debating. But we agreed that Corbin's spirit and her legacy needed to move on. And so one of our family members said, well, then let's just call it Corbin's legacy. Most said no. I said yes, and we moved on. Corbin was extraordinary. She was a teacher, first and second kindergarten, first and second grade. She almost, in fact, for her entire career, only worked and chose to work in underserved communities and schools because she felt that those children needed the most in order to be successful. She was outraged by how they were treated bureaucratically, you know, and the most famous story being that children in this country whose lunch accounts are low or completely depleted are denied access to hot lunches.
If you look up the word obscenity in the dictionary, when I learned of that, you know, my kids, I remember, you know, I mean, my kids went to school and you throw $50 in or whatever, and you go until they say, hey, you know, we got to put more money in. But I was not aware of the practice of these children who are at school being denied food because of their inability to pay at the moment, or their parents didn't fill up their card or whatever. That's all bullshit excuses. The fact is that it happens. And is it accurate that if they don't pay, the whatever food they were to get gets tossed out?
Yes. It gets worse. It's not just that they don't get the food. It's that they're embarrassed in line. They're young children, and they are told by the workers, because the workers have been told, it's not the workers' fault, that they are not to get the lunch. And so they are embarrassed in line, and they either get sort of a mark on their hand or a note pinned to their shirt to tell their parents, who I'm sure already know that they haven't filled the account, that they're not going to get hot lunch again. And then to add insult to injury, the hot lunches are thrown away. And this is a national practice.
Joan, so the bottom line is this. For whatever circumstances, these children, not of their own fault, kindergarten, first and second grade, are you kidding me? It's not their fault that they didn't keep up on this or make whatever the deal is. Because of outside circumstances, whatever those may be, a myriad of circumstances, these kids show up at school. They don't get to eat. The food that they should have eaten is thrown in the garbage, not even given to a homeless shelter, thrown in the trash.
Well, that's true. And they do get a cheese sandwich sometimes.
Well, you can live on a cheese sandwich when you're going to school eight hours a day, right?
It's humiliating. And this, more than anything else, outraged Corbin. And so every day she would go in the lunch line with her children and she would hold up a $20 bill. And no child in the school was to be and you know, the lunch costs about $2, and anywhere from $1.50 to $2.30.
And Joni, what is a hot lunch typically for $1.20, $1.50, $2? What does that consist of? Do you know?
The children have a choice. Usually there's a protein, a vegetable, a fruit, and some sort of starch. You know, that you know there could be sort of chicken tacos, but it is a hot, balanced lunch. And it is often the only balanced meal with protein that these students get.
Right.
You know, they haven't come from a home where they've had a great breakfast or are anticipating a great lunch. They suffer, almost all of them, from food insecurity.
Okay, so we need to stop the show right there. I'm 57 years young. I got a college degree. I've spent time around doing a lot of great things. Rare is it that I come across a term, a definition, or a statement that I haven't come across before in last week, either in our texting or our chatting or our conversation. You brought up this term. I'd never heard that before. Now, I'm behind the eight ball on quite a few things. This is what I don't want to be behind on. So for those of us who have not heard this before, I don't want to skip over it. What does that mean?
Food insecurity basically means that families and children do not know where their next meal is coming from. That there is no guarantee that there is food at home. There's no guarantee that there's dinner. There's no guarantee that there's breakfast.
And this is not affecting 1,000 kids. It's probably affecting tens of thousands in this country.
It would break your heart to know how many children are hungry in this country. Tens of thousands. It's really hundreds of thousands.
You know, Joni, all the POTUS candidates get up, one in particular, and start spouting off that we need policies to make America great again. Maybe if we just fed our kids, that'd be a good start.
I do believe, you know, that the problem is overwhelming. And so I've taken Corbyn's lead in that every day Corbyn's legacy tries to save as many children as they can, sort of saving the world one child at a time. Mm. We feed children every day. We give food cards to families every day. There is no shortage of need. And to be honest, in all of the candidates' policies and projections, I've never heard anything about feeding children or ending hunger.
No.
Not once. And I pay attention.
Yeah, I know you do. And so going back to when the formation of Corbyn's legacy came about and all the Leafmans are beating the crap out of each other, you know, those meetings? That was the hard part, but was it easy to go, here's our focus, feed these kids? Was that easy?
That is so interesting because in the theory and the policy and the vision and the mission, we never even had to discuss it because we all knew and know what Corbyn would have wanted. We are truly led by Corbyn's spirit and helping children with food and medical needs is exactly, you know, in addition to feeding children, we also help children because equal to children not getting food are the number of children who can't see providers. And that's particularly dangerous for children with chronic conditions.
Joni, we're going to talk about that and just, you're going to hold that thought, kid.
Okay.
You're going to put a little button on that. You're just going to sit on it for a second. You know what I'm saying?
I'll try.
This is a woman who was worried about, she didn't know what to say, and now I can't shut her up. We'll come back from this break. We're going to talk about the specifics of Corbyn's legacy. I want to talk about how people, if you're listening to this show, there's a lot of reasons I'm doing this. We'll get to those in a minute, but particularly if you're listening to the show and you have a child or know of a child that needs help, that's where this really comes into play. So while I'm all about, you know, finding out why we're here on the planet and improving your life, sometimes the best way to improve your life is to improve the lives of other people. Life Matters continues right after this.
Listening to Life Matters with John St. Augustine.
The greatest lessons that I've ever learned have not come from a book. Sorry to break the heart of all my teachers, and I taught for a couple years. But the greatest lessons I've ever learned have come from the curriculum of life. And I have this deep knowing that some way, shape, or form that I don't understand most of it, there's a process going on, even though I can't understand the process. I trust that. Never easy, not fun at times, and often heartbreaking. And in all of that, as difficult as those challenges are or can be, there's always something buried in there. There's a hidden nugget. There's something to be extracted. There's something to make make me understand it, even though I may not always accept it. And when I heard about the passing of my friend Joan Leafman's daughter, Corbin, I watched for about a year, a little bit longer than a year, kind of a interesting process that I can't understand because I don't know what that's like. When Corbin's legacy came to the forefront and I started to see what Joan was doing with some of her grief, obviously you never get over it. Let me just say this. If I hear one more person say, you got to get over it, I don't care what the it is. They should be flogged with a wet noodle, as my dad said. In this life, there is no such thing as you get over it. What does happen is you go through it over and over and over again with different levels of consciousness. Some days are easier than others. Some days you just flat get your ass kicked. So that whole concept of getting over things is a waste of time. Going through them and doing something with them and extracting things from them, to me, at least validates a little bit of whatever that challenge may be. Corbin Leafman was a dedicated teacher. She was a colleague, steadfast friend, devoted family member. She passed away at the age of 31 from cancer. Corbin was adamant about being remembered, not by her death, which is so very, very profound. How people die is not nearly as important as how they live. She was an extraordinary, compassionate, caring, and creative kindergarten teacher, first grade and second grade, taught in schools with disadvantaged youth. Her mom and her family have picked up the mantle and carried on where Corbin left off, and Joan Leafman joins me from... You're in, what, Tucson, Phoenix? Where are you?
In Phoenix.
In Phoenix. You know, Phoenix is the bird that rises from the ashes. You know this.
I know. How ironic.
How perfect. There you go. So when we talk about Corbin's legacy, and she would walk in the lunch line with a $20 bill waving around and making sure that none of the kids went hungry, you picked that was the easy part. But more than that, as I go through the things that happen there, the people that donate, what you're about, some of the other programs that you address, some of the other needs that you addressed include what?
Well, in addition to being committed to feeding children, it became very clear very early on that children have numerous needs that are not being met. One of the second greatest needs are that children need to see medical providers, and they are being turned away for any number of reasons, often that parents don't understand, primarily copays. So we had a family that spent all of their money on bus fare to take their children to take their child who has allergies and asthma to a physician, a provider, and was unable to see that provider because when they got there, there was something called a copay.
Yeah.
And they had just spent all their money on bus fare, and they were turned away.
Joni, do you think, and I heard this commercial today, for a lot of people that I know, I've never had any outside of the food insecurity statement. When I think of insurance, I'm pretty well versed in it, had to deal with it. My daughter had a kidney transplant 14 years ago, and you know, so as a family, we went through it, and you learn all these terms. When you say that copay, do you think that most people that you've had to deal with or that Corbin dealt with, their families, understand the ins and outs of insurance?
No. I know that they don't. They don't even know why they were turned away.
Yeah.
They don't know the difference between a copay and a deductible.
Mm.
They don't understand what a premium is. And that's where we've been able to step in and negotiate help for them. And I do have to say, overall, the negotiation of getting children fed and getting children seen by medical providers is far more important than the actual paying for it. It's the negotiation. We also make sure that children get medications that they need, which should sound easy, but there are some medications that can only be picked up in person, and parents work. They can't. And so we negotiate to have, so for example, we'll negotiate to have a pharmacy deliver medication to a school, will pay for after-school programs for the child, and then the parent picks up the child after they work, and they're able to get the medication for the child.
Mm.
So there's all kinds of issues that children suffer every day. They don't get the medical provision that they need. They don't get to take the medications that they need. They don't have the uniforms. We pay for uniforms.
Mm-hmm.
They don't have food at home. They don't get hot lunches. It's a war zone, and it is heartbreaking that it's sort of like a silent heartbreak.
Yeah. You know, you taught school for years, then you taught teachers to teach. I had a chance to spend 3 years at Shears High School, where I went to high school. It was very different when I came back than it was when I left there years earlier. And I know what you say on a smaller scale, as I recall it. I remember buying, you know, just a little bit of bananas and stuff for guys that came in because they hadn't eaten lunch since there was no dinner the night before. There was no breakfast. Some of these kids were on the bus for hour and 15 minutes to get to the school and all that kind of stuff. And it was like a forgotten majority, not minority. It's a majority. Now, I don't know how much it's changed there in the 18, 20 years since I've been there. But I saw this and I thought, well, how do you expect them to learn anything? How do you expect them to connect if their gas tanks are empty? How do you expect them to get anywhere? And then
that's
you think
exactly right.
Right. And then you think about it on a level of a kindergartner or first grader, second grader, these little, you know, tiny machines running around that have enough going against them. They don't need that too. And that isn't addressed. And for all the money that, you know, people out there say is raised, throwing money at a problem, don't fix it. That's crap, because what's happening with Corbin's legacy is people are donating money all through these different ways to do it, which we're going to talk about in a minute. And it is fixing something. It's changing things literally, isn't it?
Yes, and we have very strict policies. 100% of all donations go to the children. There are no administrative costs. Any administrative costs, any costs that there are, which are fairly small, the Leafman family pays for themselves. 100% of the donations go to the children. And we have successfully thus far avoided sort of becoming involved in a sort of bureaucratic policy discussion. We don't do that. We don't take sides. Every day we feed children. Every day we make sure that children see doctors. Every day we send home food for families. You know, there was one child, for example, who was in the hospital, and his mother lost her job. And she had other children, and she had to make a decision as to whether she was going to buy food or be evicted.
Oh, jeez.
And no parent should struggle like that. No child should struggle. And no parent should feel powerless. And so we paid her rent, and we got her a hotel room so that she could stay near her son, and we gave her gift cards. So that's what we do. 100% of the donations go to helping children and helping parents help children.
I went to the, by the way, here's some of the introductory part of this. If you go to www.corbinslegacy.org, at corbinslegacy.org, and you can see all the things that they've done. But I went to the page for the updates, and it says, this is great. Here's a few of the updates that Corbin's Legacy has helped: a third grader to get an eye exam and glasses, a first grader to get a complete dental exam and full treatment, a second grade classroom. Get this, a second grade classroom by supplying cases of water instead of using the brown water that was coming out of the tap. God. Five children with medical visits for illness by paying the insurance copays, as you mentioned. Two children with medical visits for chronic conditions by paying the insurance deductibles. 10 families with gift cards so that their children have food to eat at home. 30 children within an urban school district to get hot lunches daily through the end of the school year. That cost was $3,655. The benefit, of course, cannot be measured. It's incalculable. How do people typically donate, get involved? Are you doing, you know, the 5K walk and run? Are you giving out calendars? How do typically people get involved with Corbin's legacy?
That's a great question. And we've developed over the last few months some partnerships with institutions like dental schools and medical schools. And so Honor Society students are doing service. And we basically have sort of this mantra that you can become involved either by spreading the word, fundraising, or donating. And we appreciate all support in any shape or form. Donations come through the website. Service comes in many ways, and we talk to individuals and institutions on a daily basis. And fundraising does include, you know, races and diva lunches and
diva lunches. What's that?
Well,
I'm not jumping over that, sister. What's a diva lunch?
Well, recently we had. Thanks to the National Public Service Day, there's a day of service, and Corbin's Legacy partnered with A.T. Still's Masters of Public Health Department, and that's where medical and dental students, in addition to getting medical degrees and dental degrees, get public health degrees, and they're committed to serving the underserved. It's not your standard school.
Right.
And we partnered with the MPH program, and fueled by that, we created on April 6th the National Corbin's Legacy Challenge Day, where people all over the nation either spread the word or did fundraising or made donations in honor of Corbin's legacy. And the response was outstanding. There were thousands and thousands of people who participated.
Oh, wow.
It was humbling and overwhelming. And so while I was managing all of these nationally, which was pretty intense, I decided at one point that I needed to do my own Corbin's Legacy Day challenge.
Mm-hmm.
And so I happened to be back in Chicago, where I lived and taught for 30 years, as you well know.
Yes.
And at Northeastern Illinois University, there was a group of professors, women, called the Divas.
Wait. I'm sure there were professors called Divas at Northeastern?
There were five of us.
All right.
It came out of the strike.
I got it. Okay, I get it.
We were the Strike Divas, and we have remained incredibly close ever since. And so I asked the Divas if they would do a challenge, a Corbin's Legacy challenge with me. And, you know, of course, they could not have been more supportive.
Yes.
And we decided that the best thing to do in channeling Corbin was to have a diva luncheon. And we invited everyone we knew, and we had for Corbin's Legacy Day a diva luncheon where we raised funds, we spread the word, and that was my personal challenge. And we raised, I have to say, Corbin's Legacy Day challenge for a small organization, we probably raised somewhere between $15,000 and $20,000.
What?
Which is huge. And the number of children that can be helped from that is astronomical. And, you know, because we live at this point day by day, it really does allow us a little more freedom to feel like we can help a few more children daily and weekly.
That's fantastic. I didn't realize that much, and that is great, and it goes a long way to what our friend Dan Crilly has coined as the ripple effect, which I'll finish up with once you're out of here. But what I want to talk about now is, you know, now that you're doing this show, millions of people will hear you all over the known universe at some point. They can click on and listen and all that kind of stuff. This isn't just about me asking people to help you. This is about how do we have people that need help find you. And what is that process? And so, you know, I don't know, everyone has their own stuff going on. We all listen at some point to the show. And those people are in a myriad of circumstances. How can you help people as we help you?
This is a great question. And, you know, this is really, really...
You know, I just want to say something. I've asked you some really great questions because I learned it in college at Northeastern Illinois University. Go ahead.
it is a great question, and I very much appreciate it, because while we do spend time fundraising and garnering support, in my heart, I would prefer to spend all of my time and all of my sort of public moments helping children. And so we've made it extremely easy. You go to the website, corbinslegacy.org. You click on how can we help you, and there is a 9-line form.
Fill out nine lines.
And there is no reporting afterwards. It's not a grant, you know, it's a gift. We don't expect anything in return. I just have to say, we did get one great letter. I mean, we do get letters occasionally from children, but this, I think, says it all.
Okay.
It was from a first grader. It was written by him, and it said, "Thanks, Corbin's legs, I said."
Thanks, Corbin's legs.
I said. And I think that just says it all.
Yeah.
It's 9 lines, particularly for teachers who know students, for medical providers who know patients, 9 lines. And we take care of the rest.
What's impressed me the most about that approach, first of all, it's simplistic. It's 9 lines. It doesn't go through 75 review processes with paperwork up the wazoo, is something you told me last week. And I think of it this way, too. When I walk over here and I'll see a homeless person, there's a guy on the bridge on the way here where I park, and I walk across the Chicago River. He's always there, and he's blowing bubbles. And it says, you know, help me, I'm homeless. But I can blow bubbles and make you happy or something. And I look at this person, and every other time or so, I'll throw $5 in there. And, you know, people think that it's like, well, what if they use it for whatever? And I'm thinking, well, once it leaves my hands, I can't do anything about that. My intent is really where it's at. And we were talking last week in private, and you brought up the same thing, that there may be some concerns about what people are going to do or not do with it, but that's really not the point, is it?
No. And I have faith that if we give someone money for food because we think they need food, they're going to spend it on food. We have great faith that what we and how we help people will be used correctly. And if it's not, it means for some reason, they have a greater need that they haven't expressed. So we believe in people. We believe in goodness. And we believe wholeheartedly that the assistance that we give will be used correctly and to help the greatest need that person has.
So in the last couple minutes together, this is the hard question, and they're all kind of leading up to this. It's without question, even though it's a hard question, that you would rather have Corbin here. That being said, when you do this work, when you buy those gift cards, when you go and make sure that the deductible is paid or the copay is taken care of, or kids are getting fed in line, and you raise $15,000, and you know what's going to go, where that money's going to go. Are you able to draw at least a thin line to her and say she still lives because of this in some way, shape, or form?
Yes, I think we're successful in assuring that Corbin's memory and her good deeds will not be forgotten. Does it make me feel better as a parent? No. I mean, I wish I could say that it did, but I'm thrilled that what we have attempted to do is working, in that Corbin will not be forgotten, and that her good deeds will continue.
Well, of that I have no doubt. Of that, I have no doubt. So I'm going to finish this without you because I'm going to go on a bit of a rant, and it might be a little tough for you. You know what I'm saying? You can listen to it when it comes on the air, and because here's where I'm going to go with this. I'm just giving you a heads up. You don't need to stick around for this. We live in a day and age where everybody wants to do a couple things. How do I make a difference? The problems are so enormous. I'm going to tell you how you can make a difference. And then we look to all these people that are running for political office, and we listen to them tell us what the problems are and how they're going to fix them. I call bullshit on that one. And I'm going to tell you about that, too. And then the third part of this is I'm going to talk about, you know, the word legacy means in many ways to live on. And the people that I've had the fortune enough to spend time with who have passed on that made the biggest impact in my life, I think that I am obligated in some way, shape, or form to carry on their work. Whether it's my dad or Walter Payton or whoever, I feel that if they were in my orbit, I am obligated. If their life touched mine, if their work gave my life meaning, what the hell? I'm going to sit around and what? Watch Dancing with the Stars? I don't think so. So those are the three things I'm going to kind of chew on a little bit. So, Joni, I know this wasn't easy, but you were great. You should have your own show.
I don't think so. But thank you, John. And thank you for the opportunity to talk about Corbyn, as hard as it is, and to talk about Corbyn's legacy, which is easy.
That is easy. And we'll talk soon. Life Matters continues right after this.
So thanks for taking the time to listen and considering making that donation to Corbyn's legacy, feeding those kids. And once again, listen, I said this all the time. This has become like, unfortunately, I have like four or five kind of mantras going on here at the age of 60, never mind how old I'll be in 27 days. You know, when you find something in the world that needs to be fixed, you can either complain about it and say, why isn't something being done about it? And why isn't someone doing something about it? There are hungry children in our midst. For $20, you can change that by making a donation to Corbyn's Legacy. It's www.corbynslegacy.org, Corbyn's Legacy.org, Corbyn's Legacy.org. Until next time, safe travels. Thanks so very much. Be well. Adios.